This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in New York City and New Jersey.
And I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon, and I also do a lot of weight loss surgery and medical weight loss in New York City.
Welcome to She's On Call, and welcome to November.
Yeah. We have a show for you.
We do.
Yeah. You want to introduce our guests?
Sure. Today's show is all about obesity and medical issues relating to obesity. So we're going to be talking about bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery. We're going to be talking about obstructive sleep apnea. And we have two wonderful guests. We have Dr. Emma Patterson, who is a weight loss surgeon in Portland, Oregon, and Dr. Maria Serna, who is an ENT surgeon with a specialty in obstructive sleep apnea in New York City, New York.
And you guys know that we always run through the news of the week and keep you up to date on medical issues and health issues, but we are going to have to just start off the show because this week's news is really, I think, a tale of hope and despair. Like, you see some good things and then you see some bad. But we want to start off with one thing that is near and dear to all of us in healthcare, where one of our leaders really cast an aspersion on the medical community and specifically doctors, and talking about how we are misrepresenting what is happening with coronavirus.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we had there's a lot of politics going on now because the United States election is happening in 2 days, although there's been a lot of early voting. The election day itself is Tuesday, November 3rd. And in one of the rallies, one of our leaders stated that physicians and hospitals were overcounting and overallocating COVID-19 as the diagnosis for monetary gain. And I must say that none of us could take that lying down. We do not commit perjury or financial fraud in any event, and certainly not during this pandemic. The American Medical Association's president, Dr. Susan Bailey, issued a very direct response to this statement. And if we have the slide up here, she writes, "The suggestion that doctors in the midst of a public health crisis are overcounting COVID-19 patients or lying to line their pockets is malicious and outrageous and completely misguided charge." And I must say that I agree with that.
Yeah, I think we can all agree with that. But for the news of the day, now we're gonna move along a little bit. And this past Friday, unfortunately, we keep talking about coronavirus because guess what? It's still here to stay, and the vaccines are coming, but they're not here yet. And hopefully by the end of this quarter, we'll have some different version of that. Be like, there's a vaccine. You know, it's like the English are coming. Maybe the English vaccine will be ready by then. I'm not sure. But, you know, we do want to look at the U.S. numbers topped those of India on Friday. Now, India is a much larger country in terms of population. And this may, in fact, have a lot to do with the better job that the U.S. is doing of testing patients, and so our positivity was super high. And you can pull up that slide that shows the numbers. So nearly 100,000 on Friday, and it was the highest single day that we've seen for any country. And now what it's also showing, if you look at those numbers and do the math, is that one person's being diagnosed with coronavirus every second of the day, and that we have an American dying of coronavirus every 2 minutes. It's actually about every minute and a half, because the death toll in the country is at least 1,000 a day. I did the math on that, you know, I had to look it up. It's 1,440 minutes in a day. So it's a little bit over a minute and a half, or under a minute and a half.
Yeah, and COVID is now the third leading killer in the United States. So we are seeing more numbers. We are doing more testing, but the numbers reflect disease, and then we're seeing more hospitalizations and, unfortunately, an unacceptably high number of deaths. Worldwide, we are still well in the pandemic. There are a total of about 45 million cases worldwide, with a total of 1.2 million deaths in 190 countries and regions. Of great interest is that the UK just shut down all their bars and pubs and essentially put their country into lockdown yesterday. And they did this because the case numbers are going up really high. And they are joining, unfortunately, many countries in Europe, France, Greece, Ireland, a couple of others that have gone back towards more quarantine because the rates are very high. Of interest, Australia, which had been as high as France and the UK in July and has population densities at least as high in their population centers, reported zero cases for the past 48 hours. And they did this. So the science, we know. Everybody knows about the science. Every child can tell you, wear a mask, wash your hands, watch your distance. You're right. Everybody can tell you as much as we know about the science. But what's happening that's different in the countries and the areas where the cases are staying low or getting low is local leadership and community buy-in. And I think that's really important. It's actually one of the reasons Marina and I started this show, was try to bring apolitical medical information to you guys so that you could make proper decisions for yourselves, your families, and your communities.
But there is hope in all this mess, right? So there's a new study. Actually, it's not a new study. It was published earlier during the summer, that looked at hospitalized patients from March to May. It's actually a study out of NYU, where I work as well. And what the study showed is that they stratified and tried to look at age, sex, and other health conditions, and tried to also account for acuity is what we say, or severity of the coronavirus illness in patients that were hospitalized. And what they found was that during the course of time that they were evaluating patients, that the death rates had decreased, and they thought it was really related more, and we could pull up that slide, really related more to the fact that there are some mutations in the virus, and so we're not seeing as many people that are dying. And that,
yeah, I think the point that they made in the study, which was excellent, was we're seeing a less virulent virus in this area. And we also know better what to do, right? In the beginning, none of us knew what to do. And we were either throwing the kitchen sink or not. We were telling people not to come to the hospital. We're telling people, please come to the hospital. As you and I discussed last week, now that we have treatments that are approved, we seem to realize that earlier treatment, as they start going downhill, brings them back and allows for much better chance of survival. So I think these kind of studies are really what we're looking for to help us guide better care for our patients. I want to remind you all, we are live on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on scroll.in. It's Kannada Rajotsava Day in my home state of Karnataka. So it's our language day there. So happy day to everybody. But please, we see lots of people checking in from all over the country and all over the world. Please let your friends know we're on, and tag and like, because we are going to be talking about obesity, weight loss, surgery, and sleep apnea. And these are things that are really affecting large numbers of our population.
So another thing, we want to just run through a scenario just that was really recently published from El País, and we can go through that, which is really looking at what happens as it gets colder and you're inside. And you're hanging out with your friends for 4 hours, there's no masks, the windows aren't open, And when you see this scenario, all four of the patients, or all people in the room, or five actually, contracted coronavirus. Should you do the next slide?
Sure. So that was no masks, no ventilations, 4 hours of exposure. If you still have that one person who is contagious without being symptomatic, right? So these are those pre-symptomatic people. Now they have one person, masks, no ventilation, 4 hours of exposure, only one person is pretty much spared. So just wearing a mask, but staying in a closed room for extended periods of time with other people does not give you the protection that you wish. And if we go to the third scenario, which is you're wearing a mask, the room is in fact ventilated. So you've got a door open, you've got a window open, you've got some cross air flow, you've got better HVAC as they're putting in high schools. That one pre-symptomatic but contagious person now is only really affecting the one person closest to them. So the one scenario that they did not report was no masks, ventilation, and 2 hours. And so as we go into the Thanksgiving season, the holiday season, we're quite curious as to what we should do to strengthen our emotional and mental health by being with those we love while minimizing our risks of transmitting disease in that pre-symptomatic phase, which is very, very contagious, as we see with all these super spreader events happening around the country.
So I think also, I think if you're, I mean, let's face it, when we're in our houses, even if we're with our bubble or some one person comes over that, you know, has been tested and they're negative, you're not wearing masks. And I think that's a scenario that we'd love to have more information on. But in general, if you're in a ventilated area and you're keeping your distance, masks do help. I think most everyone's practicing a bubble, but you know what? We're going to get to our guests now. But just so you guys know, we're going to pop up the slide. There is an app for My COVID Risk, and it is mycovidrisk.app. So you can actually, if we can see the slide, the people, there we go. And so you can click on Know My Risk and put it in, and it'll tell you what your actual risk is. And we are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and scroll in. Please let us know if you have questions for us and for our guests, and we're so excited to introduce both of them. We are going to be talking about sleep apnea and treatment for severe obesity. And our guests are Dr. Emma Patterson, who is a surgeon in Portland, Oregon. She's really been a trailblazer. And then also we have Dr. Maria Serna, who is a ear, nose, and throat surgeon and a obstructive sleep apnea specialist. And she's here in New York with us. Now, welcome you guys. Thanks so much for joining us. This is really exciting to have you here.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So I want to say that you guys who watch us regularly, you know that Sujana brings in her ringers, right? Like, we have questions for both of you, but like Maria and Sujana know each other very well. So finally, I brought in a ringer. This is one of my best friends, Dr. Emma Patterson. She and I did our fellowship together many years ago. The exact number shall remain a minor detail for discussion. So, but we do have a lot of questions for both of you, but Maria, we're going to start off with you. And can we put up the slide for the editors, please? I knew the fix was in, because guess who is the consulting editor, and then who's the next editor after? It's Sujana Maria. Fix is in. But we want to at least, let's try, Maria, can we just discuss with our listeners what exactly is sleep apnea, and if there's more than one type, just kind of give us a little run through.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Sujana and Maria, thank you so much for the invitation. I think this is a wonderful show, and I've been very impressed and enjoyed everything you've done so far. So as far as sleep apnea is concerned, so it's a very common disorder in adult population and also pediatric as well. So it's an obstruction of the airway during sleep. So for whatever reason, people who don't have any trouble breathing during the day or when they're awake, but when they fall asleep, the airway starts to collapse. People lose their muscle tone during sleep, and the airway can either completely collapse or partially collapse, and that leads to the obstruction of breathing, and sequentially leads to oxygen saturation. And at that time, people can wake up because they try to reestablish their muscle tone and start breathing again. And that cycle kind of keeps repeating itself throughout the night. There's kind of obstruction. So this is this slide was showing the obstructive sleep apnea. That's where the tissues of the throat collapse. You can see that the base of tongue can collapse, the palate can collapse, also lower parts of the airway can collapse. And so that's considered obstructive sleep apnea because airway gets obstructed during sleep. There's also central apnea, which brain just doesn't signal for people to breathe. So there's no really airway obstruction. Airway still remains patent, but patients just like, you know, or people just don't breathe during sleep. And so that's considered to be central apnea. There are also mixed apneas, where people can have obstructive and central apneas. So, and those are kind of different ways that can manifest. Airway can obstruct completely or partially obstruct. And so that also helps to differentiate the degree and severity of sleep apnea and how often and how frequently for how long the airway obstructs during sleep.
Maria, can we go back to that slide and just go through it in a little detail? You went fast, and I just want to go through this because this is, this is the pandemic, right? Mood changes, lack of concentration, memory loss, and daytime sleepiness, and I can't sleep. Okay, the only thing I don't have is morning headaches every morning, although, you know. So let's just go through this a little because it's funny, you know, we would always say, like, oh, I must have been snoring last night. My throat is a little sore, right? Like, because, you know, I don't actually ever think I snore. I kind of tell people.
That's true. So you're going to getting into the symptoms of sleep apnea. So exactly. So most of the time, people are not even aware that they have sleep apnea. And it's usually their bed partners or their family members who report that people make noises, make actually very loud noises or snore or choke or gasp for air during sleep. They also wake up throughout the night. Actually going to the bathroom frequently throughout the night is actually one of the common complaints. People wake up with sore throat, with dry mouth. They wake up with headaches, and often they feel like they slept for many hours, but still don't feel refreshed and kind of feel like they didn't get a quality sleep during the night. Again, those are some of the sleepiness during the day, falling asleep during the day, falling asleep driving, not having like ability to concentrate during like work or in general, and so wanting to fall asleep earlier than intended. So those are some of the signs to look for. But again, most of the time, people become aware of their problem is that when their bed partners actually bring up the awareness.
You know, when I was a resident, I remember distinctly this big guy, and it's often big barrel chested, people who came in, and he said, his wife was bothered by his snoring and his apnea, as was his girlfriend. Like, man, I can't get a date to save my life. And both of these women are bothered by you. I also remember, because back in the bad old days at Bellevue, one of my assignments as a first-year ENT resident was to go to the men's shelter, which let people in at 11 p.m., so you had to go around 12, 1 a.m. when they were kind of settled in, find the sleep apnea patient who was having his surgery tomorrow, and bring them in, because we admitted them the night before, and he was the easiest guy to find, right? You just follow your ear and you found the man who was snoring and choking and snoring and choking, which we can make fun of, but this is a really serious problem and it really affects many organ systems. So can you talk to us a little bit, Maria, about how you test for this? And one of our listeners actually sent in a picture of her Fitbit that I want to talk to you about in a second. So can you tell us about some of the testing?
So, yes, to get back to your point that a lot of people, the bed partners are the ones who actually get bothered a lot. And a lot of times people, when they snore and sleep apnea patients, they tend to be not that symptomatic. At least some of them are not as symptomatic as you would expect them to be. Or maybe sometimes they're just not aware that they do have symptoms. And so A lot of times it's the family members, bed partners, or even now with the technology, since you brought up the Fitbit, patients can become aware of problems with their sleep by just like, you know, monitoring their sleep. So when people come in for evaluation of sleep apnea or for sleep problems, you generally want to take a good history and understand like what is going on with their sleep, because not everybody who has sleep problems really has sleep apnea. If their suspicions for sleep apnea is pretty high, meaning that people are snoring, gasping for your obstruct during sleep, or there's also daytime sleepiness, the next step would be to do a sleep study. And so what is a sleep study? Sleep study is the evaluation of sleep, evaluation of what's happening during sleep of the individual. And there's different ways to do that. So traditionally, classically, there's a sleep study, which is polysomnography, which is done in the lab, in the sleep lab. That's when people go into the lab. It's kind of, they have a separate room and they get a bunch of wires attached to their head, to their chest. And they sleep with it, with all those wires. And what's done during that time, they basically get monitors to see what happens during sleep. They have like brain waves that are being monitored and see what stages of sleep they're in, and also monitor oxygen saturation, heart rate, and how many obstructive events they have per hour. And then there's option for a home sleep study where the equipment is much smaller. It's a little bit more comfortable. It gets done in the setting of their home, and people can take the equipment home and actually do the same evaluation, but in a home setting.
Emma and I both use those home sleep studies, right?
Yeah, so now we routinely do the home sleep studies. And let's just say 20 or so years ago when I started in practice, I decided to go out on a bit of a limb in bariatric surgery and routinely sleep study everybody. And that was really, based on one patient of my fellowship, very big guy, like body mass index of over 60, you know, so he was around 400 pounds or so. And I went around on him the morning after surgery, and he was just sitting on the edge of his bed, just panting and desaturating. And he ended up actually being transferred to the ICU and got intubated for severe, undiagnosed, untreated sleep apnea. And, you know, that really hit me hard. And I was like, oh, wow, well, clearly, you know, we should clue into this. And so we actually studied it was 2004, I think. So we studied all my patients pre-op. And previously it was thought that in bariatric surgery, about 15% of our patients with morbid obesity had sleep apnea. And in fact, when we just routinely studied everybody, we found 80% had it. Now, a few were coming in already with that diagnosis, but we diagnosed sleep apnea in 77% of people who otherwise didn't know they had it. And over half of those were moderate or severe, where there's pretty good evidence for CPAP. Back in those days, I had a lot of pushback on patients having the sleep study because they had to come in the lab and hooked up, and they didn't feel like it was a normal night's sleep. So it's quite a bit easier now getting them to have the sleep study. We've just made it easier with the home studies, and I think they're more accurate than they used to be, although they do tend to, the sleep specialists tell me, they do underestimate the severity of the sleep apnea a little bit. So if someone's kind of borderline, you know, an AHI of 13, 14, I'll still encourage them to get the CPAP.
Emma, can you tell our audience what AHI means, please?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Sorry. AHI, apnea hypopnea index. And so that's the that's an estimate we use of the severity of the sleep apnea, and that counts the number of times that a patient either stops breathing or their breathing significantly slows down to abnormal in an hour. So severe is considered over 30 an hour, so like every 2 minutes. So you're not getting restful sleep. I was actually just reading, there's a consensus guideline apparently now about put out from Amsterdam and sleep apnea and bariatric sleep apnea in general. And they're proposing, and I thought this was a good idea, I wonder what you ENT docs think about this, is that we probably need some, you know, higher grades, like over 30. I have patients, I don't know what the highest AHI you have seen, but I've seen over 120. And, you know, my fellows used to joke, oh, they're dying every night in their sleep. It's like, yeah, they're lucky to wake up every morning. And one other thing about it is if a patient is giving me pushback on the sleep study, a quite can easily talk them into getting, or want to say, well, I'm not going to do your surgery. Don't do it. But otherwise, to try to get them to buy in terms of their health, is that, of course, can be severe damage to the heart and lungs, something called pulmonary hypertension, where the blood flow to the lungs is significantly increased, is actually a very bad thing. There you go. And also, getting good sleep is the first step, I think, to weight loss. We know that lack of sleep and that waking up so many times every night, it's a big stress response. And yeah, all of these things are connected. Diabetes, hypertension, impotence, there you go. All of these things. And sleep apnea, I think, really should be part of the metabolic syndrome. They all go together. And so I just think it's important first step for bariatric surgery. And one of my favorite things that happens is I've had the patient have the sleep study and get the CPAP, and we're still pre-op, and they come in and they're like, oh, thank you so much, you've changed my life so much already. I'm like, okay, well, wait till I do the surgery, but I'm so happy for you, you feel so great already, you know.
So this is wonderful, Emma, because I think this really speaks to us not staying in our individual silos of expertise, but you as a scientist, taking something that you noticed, something horrible, frankly, that you noticed about a person getting really quite sick after a different type of intervention, mm-hmm. making a study out of it and really changing the way medicine is practiced. We've gone from the in-house sleep studies to the home sleep studies, and Ellen Austin, who's one of our routine viewers, regular viewers, thank you so much, says, you know, it's really hard to sleep with all that stuff on you. It's really hard. And people are concerned that those sleep studies are not representative of their normal sleep because they're all hooked up with stuff. So now we have Fitbits and smartwatches that tell you that you've slept. And one of my friends sent me this picture yesterday, actually, and said, how can my Fitbit tell me that I had a good sleep when I only slept for 4 hours and 33 minutes? How is that ever any good? And Maria, I wonder if you can talk to us about, as technology moves forward, how do we help our patients understand what their technology is telling them?
Yeah. So that's a very good point. The technology is getting smaller and it's getting much more comfortable. Even home sleep studies now just use like literally like a finger probe with that monitors like, you know, oxygenation and like arterial tone and heart rate, and then also position of the person during sleep. So home sleep studies actually are getting much, much more reliable and much more convenient and comfortable. So wearable technology, this is something that's been popularized recently. And again, the technology is getting smarter and everybody's monitoring their activity, how many steps they take, how many hours they sleep. They monitor their oxygen saturation during sleep. So it becomes very accessible to a lot of people. And I think it's great. Because it allows people to monitor and track what's happening to them during sleep. And to your point, that could be a first way for people to recognize that they actually have some sort of problem, that they have disrupted sleep, they have disturbance during sleep, and maybe they move too much, maybe their oxygenation drops pretty low, or they actually wake up throughout the night, they have restless sleep, and also gives you a number of hours of sleep per night. It's considered that people should get about 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night in order to get the most benefit from it. However, it should be noted that there are some people who genetically might not require as much sleep as average person. And so going back to the Fitbit picture that you put up earlier, yes, this person didn't sleep for 7 to 8 hours, only slept for about 4.5 hours. But if you look at the quality of sleep, looks like the quality of sleep was actually pretty good. So the amount of time that your friend was asleep, she actually didn't wake up. She was pretty, she was asleep and went through different stages of sleep.
So can you tell us what that means? Like there's a graph, there's dark blue, there's light blue, there's up, there's down. Can you just describe for us very briefly what that means? What are you guys looking for when you're looking at these sleep studies?
So again, this is not a representative of what a sleep study graph would look like. This is more of a Fitbit. This is a wearable technology. And I have to comment that wearable technology has not been tested to the same level and has not gone through the proper evaluation as some of the technologies we use to actually diagnose sleep apnea in the home sleep studies and the polysomnography, which is in-lab sleep study. This technology is pretty good in detecting how many, whether the person is asleep or awake, because they use the motion sensor. And if people are asleep, they usually don't move. And so that basically is associated with being asleep. And then when there are movements or activity, that gets picked up as a awakening. This technology also reports that they do have ability to monitor which stage of sleep person is in. And usually sleep is not like, you know, uniform kind of state. You go through different stages of sleep. You go through light sleep, deep sleep, and you go through REM sleep. And REM sleep is the rapid eye movement sleep, but that's the stage when you dream mostly. And throughout the night, you kind of go back and forth through different stages. And so that's what those graphs show, that it's supposedly that person was in light sleep, then a deeper sleep, and maybe get back to, again, light sleep and deep sleep. And it tries to measure how much also like a quality of sleep, because you want people to go through different stages of sleep throughout the night. And REM sleep, we still don't really understand like what is the importance of REM sleep. But you want to have sufficient amount of REM sleep. And that, again, prevalence of REM sleep increases towards the end of the night. So that's why if you shorten the period of sleep, you might not necessarily get to adequate levels of REM sleep as well. But whether how accurate that is on the technology, the wearable technology, I don't know. I would probably be a little bit cautious interpreting stages of the sleep.
It's so funny because first of all, we want to thank our viewers for your comments. We so enjoy them. Someone just wrote that she had an older Fitbit and didn't realize the new ones track sleep, and so she was wondering if she should upgrade. You know, I'll say in the surgeon's lounge, I went in there like a couple of years ago. I mean, I go in there all the time, but this story is from a couple of years ago, and one of the surgeons was like, yeah, my watch is now tracking my sleep, and I'm so excited. I'm like, why do you want anything to track you any more than you're already tracked during the day? Like, I get sick of how many steps I've been taking because it's, you know, it's like it's complaining to me, my phone, right? Like, you didn't walk enough today. And now I'm gonna sleep and collect all this info. It seems outrageous. But it is funny, if you don't sleep well or you wake up tired, that this is definitely something that has been an impact. And I believe Apple Watch has a new thing where they're going to try and pick up your oxygen saturation as well. So things are going to get pretty invasive even when you're asleep. And again, thank you for you guys for your comments. Again, we're live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and you can tag your friends, especially, or tag your loved ones or someone you're concerned about their sleep apnea or something, that say, hey, look what I'm watching. But I want to ask Emma a few questions. We finally found the slide, Emma's article. We're going to put that up, right? Emma has been a thought leader in bariatric surgery. And, this article is one of many. She has great insight into her daily work and what we do for our patients. And so I've actually quoted this paper a lot. Although, Emma, I'll tell you honestly, I would say, like, we found 86%. My friend found 86%. Now I know for sure it's 77, but I might still say
it. Well, 80% total, because some did come with the diagnosis, but we diagnosed 77%. And, you know, the funny thing was when my fellow Terrence presented this, and I think the meeting was in Boston that year at our national bariatric meeting, even though we had this, and the great thing about a sleep study, you have so much objective data, right? You have all the data. And he put it up there. We studied everyone. And I got to say, I shouldn't diss gray hair anymore since I have some, but let's say a lot of the older folks in the room, got up to the mic and literally tried to blow him away saying, no, you're wrong. We all know it's only 15% have sleep apnea. I was like, were you not paying attention? He just showed you the data.
Yeah. So, I want to get into, you brought up our national meeting and you know, that is one of our bariatric surgery meetings. And I definitely want to run through the different operations with you and get you to kind of describe it for our listeners.
Sure.
I think we're going to start off with gastric bypass. We're going to pop up a photo and you can kind of talk people through it.
We'll see a photo. There you go. It's been around the longest, like since the 60s. And that's a picture there of the stomach and the skinnier parts of the intestines. And so what we do there is staple and cut across the stomach to create that tiny stomach there, just up at the lower part of the esophagus. It's about the size of a golf ball. And then we measure down some intestine and cut that and bring it up and connect to that little pouch. And so as it sounds, the food bypasses the stomach, just goes into the tiny part of the stomach and then straight into the small bowel. And then so we make another connection there down lower. So the bile and pancreatic juices can meet up with the food down lower. Often you'll see this if people are researching this at home, called the Roux en Y, and it's just because we make that bowel in a Y shape. And you know, it's
after that surgery, Emma.
Pardon me?
After that surgery, people tell me that they can't have a big meal, right? Because they don't have that big stomach. You've yes. separated it. So, what kind of advice do you give people for how to eat? Obviously before the surgery, but then after the surgery, and what do mm-hmm. you do about nutrition, and yeah. and is there something special they have to do after that?
Well, for sure, yes. Yeah. So with the gastric bypass, I mean, they are at risk of some nutritional deficiencies because the food isn't going through that first part of the small intestine where a lot of things are absorbed, particularly iron, and then some B12 in the stomach. So it's really, really important that the patient commits to following up long term. And when they ask me what's long term, I tell them, well, 20 years, you know, or forever, you know, because we really do have to check their vitamin levels. They do have to take some vitamins. And that's become a lot easier now. There's several companies that focus on vitamins for bariatric patients, and they make them, you know, tasty and chewable and well absorbed. So it's become easier. But I have had patients who've had a bypass and they disappear for a few years. And they could come back very malnourished. So really important they take the vitamins. And then to answer your first question about eating, because they can only eat a little bit, they really have to focus on the good stuff. And the good stuff is lean proteins and vegetables. You know, and so that's what pretty much all of us promote in bariatric surgery. Get your protein first, get your vegetables for, you know, the fiber and vitamins there too, and prebiotics. And really avoid the carbs. So there is a side effect that they can get after the bypass that it's sort of a double-edged sword. It's sort of like they dread it, but they want it. And it's called dumping syndrome. And so that's where if they eat simple carbs, if they eat sugar, too much sugar, more than like one bite of cake. I'm like, you can get away with a bite of cake, but you probably can't eat a slice of cake. And if they do, you know, and that sugar goes rapidly into the small intestine, which isn't used to seeing that much sugar quickly in the normal anatomy, they feel really unwell. So dumping syndrome is it that sugar's dumping into the bowel and they feel they like the heart races, they can break out in sweat, cramps, diarrhea, just feel like they have to lay down.
That'll make you stop eating cake.
Exactly. And really, like when patients ask me about that, I'm like, well, honestly, not everybody has it, but if I could create an operation where everybody got dumping syndrome every time they had sugar, I mean, I'd probably get a Nobel Prize for that, you know, because it's so addictive, sugar.
Can we talk about gastric, vertical sleeve gastrectomy? So we started with the biggest, and let's just go a little bit smaller and smaller. So
yeah.
You know, it's very interesting because I'm the ENT and I'm going to ask you more questions because there's so much I don't know. Marina's the minimally invasive weight loss surgeon, and she's going to ask Maria questions because I think this is the greatest way to exchange information. Many of our listeners are writing in that they really appreciate all the information you lovely women are giving us.
I have some sleep apnea questions for you later too. Yes, so the sleeve now. The sleeve, in fact, Marina and I trained with the surgeon who invented the sleeve, Dr. Michel Gagné. He's a Canadian surgeon, very famous. And so it's just as shown here, we actually removed 3/4 of the stomach. And so we staple and cut and remove that part. Of course, it's all, there's a ton of blood vessels in there that we have to divide and take down and carefully dissect it off the spleen. And so it's called a sleeve. People often think, oh, you're putting a sleeve thing in me. It's like, no, there's no foreign body here. We're just, surgeons, we're kind of simplistic. And so it's just a tubular, it's a long, skinny tube that looks like a shirt sleeve. And so that's really why he called it the sleeve. And this is now actually the most popular weight loss surgery in the U.S. and worldwide. It's more than 80% of procedures now. And I think it's because, you know, it just seems to have the best risk-benefit ratio for most people. It gets you very close to the weight loss of a gastric bypass, but with probably about half the number of complications and way less nutritional problems. They still have to take vitamins, but because food is going through the stomach and through the whole normal intestine, they don't get iron deficiency, which is probably the biggest long-term nutritional problem with the bypass. And this surgery, you know, it's done. It takes less than an hour. I do them actually as an outpatient in a surgery center. So we do have them spend the night. It's a 23-hour stay, but they leave the next morning. And then the diet, I have to go carefully with the diet initially. You know, it's a couple of weeks of liquids and a couple of weeks of puree, but the weight loss is very good. You still have to work at it, of course, and follow-up's important. You know, we promote the diet and exercise because I have a saying with weight loss surgery. I mean, it's different. It's different, say, from cancer surgery, where there's nothing good about cancer. You want to cut it all out. Whereas nutrition is different. It's like we still have to be able to eat. So I can't just cut out the whole stomach. But if I leave enough stomach that you can eat chicken and vegetables, well, you can eat donuts and candy too. So if you can eat, you can cheat. But most people don't want to, you know, they really want to lose weight. And so I find a bariatric surgery, like we're surgeons and we're coaches and cheerleaders for the patients, you know, and that's a big part of the follow-up is encouraging them and suggestions and things like that.
I have a question. Or Emma. So you were just talking about some of the surgical procedures, which seem to be pretty invasive and could potentially, like, you know, also have some associated complications. What about some of the less invasive methods like lab bands or balloons that kind of like that could potentially be used for, and what's the indication and what's the, how would you select who would be the better person for those minimally invasive procedures first?
Yeah, I would say really the, that's a loaded question. Basically the patient mainly self-select. I mean, bands, I did a lot of lap bands over the years, and it was, you know, back 20.
Let me jump in. I'm not sure if she got, kicked off, but lap band was done very frequently in the earlier part of the 2000s. And then, yeah, are you back?
There you go. And so there's this little tube that connects to a port that goes just under the skin, and we could add or remove fluid. So this is definitely the least invasive of the actual surgeries because there's no cutting or stapling, and so there's minimal risk of, say, bleeding or leaks, which are things that are the significant risks in bariatric surgery. And I have many patients who still have bands or doing well with bands. I'm honestly not putting very many in anymore because the sleeve has become so safe now. I mean, if you do it well, I mean, the risks of the sleeve are minimal, I think, in the right hands. And the thing to remember about weight loss surgery is we're not doing this to make people look pretty. I mean, they do, but we're doing this because, you know, being significantly overweight is a big risk to your health. And so there's very good data now showing that in bariatric surgery, we save lives through preventing cancers and preventing heart attacks and strokes. So that's always a thing to keep in mind. And then there are some endoscopic things such as gastric balloons. And so then it's no surgery at all. Everything is done down the mouth. And I put in some balloons. Those are temporary, you know, just can stay in for 6 months because that strong acid in the stomach would break down the balloon and it would burst and cause a bowel obstruction. So I do some of those. Weight loss is less are indicated for smaller patients. So I tend to think the less invasive things like balloons and lap bands are for me it's like class one. Obesity, body mass index, say of 30, 35, like 30 to 50 pounds overweight. And then sleeve for, you know, a little bit bigger patients, body mass index of 40 or like 50 to 75 pounds or more overweight. What do you think, Marina?
Oh, I completely, well, I agree and I don't agree. Sometimes I think, you know, you said the most important thing, patients self-select, my job, your job, and we're all surgeons. Our job is to really let the patients know what the risks, the benefits are, and discuss what our expected outcomes are from these different procedures. And so I will say I completely agree that the sleeve gastrectomy is the most popular operation that we have. And but there are still patients that come for band. And as you pointed out, in this country, we have a significant number of band patients that are actually still doing well. Some haven't, some do require a different procedure. And I think the difference is that when we're doing a bypass in a sleeve, we're working with patients' native tissues. And when we're doing a lap band or putting in a gastric balloon, we're basically inserting a foreign body. And so there can be device-related issues that pop up. And that can kind of result in reoperations or early removals of the gastric balloon. And I put in some gastric balloons as well. But, you know, we have some great medications out there. And this is not a show on medications. But put up, actually, we can put that slide up of the medical meal replacements if you have that. If not, I'm going to send that to you guys. Maybe we can talk about some of the devices that we have for sleep apnea or appliances.
So we have an audience question about different ways that you can sleep, like positions of sleep or sleep routines that you can follow to avoid sleep apnea, and maybe it's to avoid snoring. And then I wonder, Maria, if you could tell us about the Malinpati scale of what the crowded back of the throat looks like, and then very briefly talk to us about CPAP, about dental devices, and about hypoglossal nerve stimulators. So you have to give us a master class in sleep apnea in about 5 minutes.
It's a lot of information here. Sleep apnea is a complicated disorder, and it's actually a multifactorial problem. So there is a very strong genetic predisposition to having sleep apnea. Then we were talking about weight being an independent factor that contributes to sleep apnea. And as Emma pointed out, people above certain BMI have very high likelihood of having sleep apnea. And then there's other factors, like, you know, sometimes people have a smaller jaw, like crowded airway, like large tonsils. Sometimes also people have more of a positional sleep apnea, also REM stage related sleep apnea. And so when we talk about treatments, we try to individualize in the kind of focus the treatment, gear the treatment, I guess, towards each individual person. We have to understand what is in that individual case driving the sleep apnea. So since there was a question about what can be done to prevent sleep apnea, well, some of the simple things could be, one, if it's a positional sleep apnea, you can avoid sleeping on your back, because people tend to have more sleep apnea, more airway obstruction when they're laying on their back because their muscles relax and their tongue falls back. Then also things like sedating medications, alcohol, all of those things make sleep apnea worse. So try to avoid alcohol or anything that's make you more sedated before going to bed. Also heavy meals late at night, reflux, those things can make sleep apnea worse as well. So then when it comes to treatment, the gold standard treatment of sleep apnea is still considered to be CPAP, or continuous positive airway pressure. Now there are also variations on AutoPAP, which is auto-titratable positive airway pressure machine, and then there is BiPAP. So that's the machine that gets placed over the nose or over the mouth, and it blows positive pressure into the airway, and that stents the airway open. And so that prevents like tissues from collapsing. That is an effective treatment as long as you use it. You have to use like PAP throughout the entire night, every night, for it to be effective. Then there is dental appliances, oral appliances. Okay, so the image of what the masks look like. Now, nowadays, masks actually are different. Like they're more, can be more comfortable. They're masks that could go just over the nose or under the nose. And sometimes it's just a matter of finding the proper mask for individual person to ensure the comfort during sleep. Then there are dental appliances. There's a custom-made like mouth guards that gets placed into the mouth over the teeth. And what they do, they bring the lower jaw forward. And by bringing the jaw forward, it also pulls the tongue and base of tongue and tissues forward as well. And that opens up the airway and allows for easier breathing during sleep. And then if those treatment options, such as PAP and oral devices, positional therapy, also elevating the head of bed can potentially be helpful. If those don't work, then we start looking into surgical treatment options. And Sujana, you asked me about the Mellon Potty score or tonsillar size. I don't know if we have a slide for that, but that's something that we use to assess how crowded the airway is, whether we can, by looking in the back of the throat, actually visualize the entire back of the throat, or is the tongue elevated so high that we can only see, like, not even can't even see the uvula. And so people who have more crowded airway, and when you actually, the airway doesn't look as open, they tend to be more likely to have potentially sleep apnea, and also will be less likely to respond to any kind of surgical treatment. And when we talk about surgery, there is surgery kind of traditional sense, surgical procedures where we're trying to remove tissue from the back of the throat, like, you know, at the base of the tongue to open up the airway. And those tend to be, you know, uncomfortable, pretty painful. But again, the goal is to open up the airway as much as possible. There's some surgeries that actually break the jaw and move the jaw forward. And that also can be done, especially in people who have like a smaller jaw and have like some craniofacial abnormalities. And then kind of more recent and the more newer way of managing sleep apnea is actually a neurostimulation device. It's a hypoglossal nerve stimulator, which is could be thought of as maybe like a implantable device, a pacemaker-like device that gets inserted under the skin, and the wire gets connected to the nerve, hypoglossal nerve, and that nerve innervates muscles of the tongue, and it also innervates muscles of the throat. And so when you turn that device on at night, that, okay, here's a actually nice visualization of it. So it's an implantable device. You can actually turn it on at night before going to bed with a remote control, and that starts to monitor the breathing pattern through the sensing lead, and then delivers neurostimulation with each breath to keep to stiffen up the muscles, to release the muscle tone, and pull the tongue forward and open up the airway to allow for easier breathing during sleep. So that has been very successful, and
Is that that's a new technology, Maria?
Yes, that's actually very new. It's
I just saw a commercial for this. I was going to ask you about this. I'm like, how does that work? They show a guy, he's got this little white box, and there's nothing on his face, and he hits a button, and he puts it on the nightstand. He says, I'm going to sleep, and I'm having my sleep apnea treated. I'm like, what is that? I've got to know about this. I just saw a TV commercial.
Oh, wait. So what's so funny is that in our prep for the show, Sujana was like, hey, next week, it's the battle of ENT versus bariatric surgeons. And I was like, dude, we don't have the battle. But I want to ask Emma, this is great to do all these treatments for sleep apnea. And definitely even our patients after weight loss surgery, some of them might still need devices. But Emma, if you could comment on resolution of comorbid conditions. And I pulled up a meta-analysis from Dr. Buchwald, who is a great pioneer in weight loss surgery, but he did a recent meta-analysis that was really great. And so we'll pull that up, and you can see that while weight loss surgery does bring your weight down, it really can impact other conditions.
And that, I mean, that's the beauty of bariatric surgery, right? I mean, that's why we love it, I think. I mean, patients are so happy losing all this weight, but so many of the medical problems get better with weight loss surgery. Like, it affects the whole body. So, yeah, I would say it's, I mean, if someone, you know, like you were describing, Maria, some thin people, right, with a tiny jaw can have sleep apnea, but obesity is the biggest risk factor. So if someone qualifies for weight loss surgery, which actually we've lowered our criteria these days in our society, I mean, BMI of 30 can have a sleep. Now, the insurance company might not pay for it, but the patient could come and have it and improve their overall health, prevent cancers, heart attacks, and strokes, and also treat the sleep apnea. So I think if they have obesity, is that systematic review popping up? But it's you know, they should have weight loss surgery, and then if they still have sleep apnea, you could do this hypoglossal nerve thing. Do you guys still do UPPPs for sleep apnea or no? Because I didn't. I've done surgery on a lot of patients who still have sleep apnea. There we go. So they found that sleep apnea resolved or improved in 85% of patients. And, you know, we have that kind of effect on diabetes, high cholesterol, hypertension. So it's really fun to, you know, to do this and improve people's sleep apnea. And I've had many people who have had UPP and they still have severe sleep apnea. So do you still offer the UPP or no? Part of the palate.
Yeah.
Uvulopalatopharyngoplasty. Yeah. So you
the UPPP.
Yeah, this is actually historically like the surgery for sleep apnea that we ENT use. Like, you know, basically if CPAP fails, that's the next go-to procedure. Yeah. And unfortunately, it hasn't been as effective as we would like it to be. But that said, if person has a proper anatomy, it can still be a very good surgery for in a properly selected patient. So we still do perform it, but we don't just perform it on every single person who failed CPAP. I tend to be very selective to whom I offer that surgery. People who have like large tonsils, crowded, like, you know, upper airway at that, you know, pharyngeal level, they a lot of times can still benefit from this surgery and have pretty satisfactory outcomes after like 2 weeks of pretty bad sore throat. So, but.
And do you release some of those nerve stimulators? Have you done some of those?
Oh, I've been doing them for the past 6 years. Actually, I started offering that surgery in 2015 in New York after FDA approval. So it's been FDA approved since 2014. And I've been offering the surgery to my patients for the past 6 years now. So it's very.
And what were the results? Like, what kind of results do you see? Do you have another sleep study with them on it? And what kind of do you see?
Yeah, absolutely. So patients, after they get implanted, I do a follow-up. So we turn on the device, we activate the device in about a month after surgery, and then we teach them how to use it. They start using the device every night. And then about a month or two after device activation, we do a follow-up sleep study to see how effective the device is. And a lot of people have really, really good success. And actually, all the surgical procedures that we offer for sleep apnea, I think this one gives people the best chance, other than bariatric surgery for overly obese patients. But
I guess it was a battle, Marina. We won.
I want to say. First of all, it's wonderful to have great guests and such experts. It's also great to see you guys interview each other, which is fine. We can just sit back, you know, so that was great. But we are toward the end of the show. So, you know, Emma, you want to give us 3 takeaways and then Maria, and then we're going to end up introducing our next show.
I would say bariatric surgery saves lives. In our patients, sleep studies should be routine. And good sleep's important for weight loss.
Maria?
So my takeaways is that good sleep is very important, and evaluation and early diagnosis and treatment can be life-changing from a medical and social aspect. Properly targeted treatment can be again, as I said, life-changing. And again, keep in mind, sleep apnea is extremely prevalent. It's very common. And so having awareness of symptoms and what to look for, and then coming in for evaluation is really important.
So I want to thank our production team as well. Thank you guys, first of all. This show can't be done without a great team behind us. And so we'll show cue our slide of our producers. This is really a team effort. And Suji, you want to introduce next week guests.
Sure. So next week, we are going to have a show devoted to psychiatry and mental health. And our guests are Dr. Jessica Gold, who's assistant professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. She's a founding member of Time's Up Healthcare and an expert in college and physician well-being, and Victor Pereira Sanchez, who is a psychiatry fellow at New York University School of Medicine and founder of the World Network of Psychiatric Trainees. And his area of expertise is adolescent and child psychiatry. And that's just in time for our post-election feelings. So please tune in. And coming back to our guests, thank you so much. You were fantastic today, and you really taught us a great deal. Don't forget to vote, everybody who's in the United States, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. See you next week.